press play.
Curtain up and now we're in.
It's time to taste in
the shade and tea to spill.
Ooh, drama.
Ooh, that's a tweet. Did they book?
Who got nominated?
They optioned no.
Oh, I'm not well.
What star will we talk to today? Oh, that's a gag, honey.
Say no more. Drama.
Drama. Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love,
and life.
I'm Connor McDowell.
And I am Dylan McDowell. And as listeners can tell by the snappy repartee that's going on right now, we are indeed together.
No Zoom delay.
Yes.
You're here in New York on this trip. This has been an epic week.
I know. It's like my annual show binge. You know, people often think, do you still live in New York? And I just say, no, I just visit Connor quarterly.
Well, and so, I mean, there's obviously more product than ever on Broadway, off Broadway, yeah, et cetera, to do in the city. So you've crammed this week in with, I mean, we're only halfway through.
Which is insane to think about.
You want
to
say?
So I got here Monday and we saw Stereophonic.
Which you said is your favorite.
Everything that has followed. I just keep thinking about Stereophonic, but I've loved it all. I've loved it all. Yeah.
I need to go.
I know. You do. Because I think it's going to sell out. The Notebook, The Who's Tommy, The Outsiders. We saw Cabaret last night. Unreal.
Oh my God.
And then tomorrow is Gatsby. And then a mystery final show on Sunday. So people have to listen to our Patreon to find out what that show is going to be.
Meaning it's a mystery to us.
Exactly.
We haven't chosen yet.
There's so many things to pick from.
I wish we could ask listeners that question like a week ago so they could give us
because now it's going to be a scramble
recommendation.
But listen, I need everyone to, every single show I just listed, y'all have got to go see them all. Do the rush, get the online, get the cheap, you know, do whatever you got to do to be there. Now there is one show this season that I missed because I didn't get here in time to see it.
Well, you would have this week. But
I would have, but it would have probably been tough with its final week. And it was Days of Wine and Roses. And I'm going to say it. I'm pissed.
I know.
That I didn't get the chance to see it.
I'm devastated that you missed it too.
I know.
Because, oh my God. I mean, we're going to get into it.
Yeah.
You know, Kelly is like my fave.
Yeah, I do.
But we have another fave here.
An absolute hero.
I can't believe he's doing this.
I think like, when was the first time we were exposed to him?
Oh my God. It might have been Shrek.
I mean, that Broadway season was pivotal for us.
Huge.
Next to normal.
And won the Shrek lottery.
We did.
Wait, that's crazy.
An in-person lottery.
On a, family trip.
Yeah.
What would we have done if we didn't win Shrek? I mean, I don't know.
We were lucky.
I remember the stage was so high.
Yeah.
And we were so short that I didn't know you could ask for like a booster seat at, you know.
Listen, that's a hack that some people need to find out.
I know.
Listen, we've got him, the guy.
I'm so ready. You know what's funny? I remember listening to Shrek, not to make myself seem so young, but while the summer I was learning how to drive.
Oh, okay.
I can remember listening to like, I Know It's Today and being like, today I'm going to get my license.
Oh my God. I'm sure you like posted that online with the caption. I know. Today I'm getting my license.
I know. But anyway, okay. I know. And this bio is so big. We're splitting it in half.
Which we also had to do with Kelly O'Hara.
I love this.
So there's a lot of parallels happening.
Yeah. All right. So y'all listen, our guest today is a Grammy winner and 4-time Tony Award nominee. Impossible to pin down for being best known for any of his iconic roles and appearances across Broadway, television, and the big screen. His Tony-nominated performances include The Baker in Into the Woods, the titular role in Shrek the Musical, Nick Bottom in Something Rotten, and Sydney in The Sweet Smell of Success. Or is it just Sweet Smell of Success? Is there a the? Drop the thug? Okay, anyway. Our other Broadway turns are the recent Days of Wine and Roses, The Ferryman, Hamilton, Next to Normal, The Apple Tree, Titanic, Macbeth, Carousel, Blood Brothers, The Lieutenant of Inishmore, and more. He's an Obie and Drama Desk Award winner for his varied and extensive work in the theater on Broadway and off, including originating roles in The Good Thief, Giant, The Wild Party, Floyd Collins, and more.
On film, he starred in the 2016 Academy Award-winning Best Picture, Spotlight, alongside Michael Keaton, Mark Ruffalo, and Rachel McAdams as the 4-member Spotlight columnists. He was awarded the 2016 SAG Award, Critics' Choice Award, Gotham Award, and the Independent Spirits Robert Altman Award for Best Ensemble for his portrayal of Matt Carroll. You'll also recognize him as Officer Krupke from Steven Spielberg's 2022 Oscar-nominated West Side Story, as well as First Man, Dark Phoenix, Molly's Game, Sisters, and more, literally just to name a few. Highlights from his countless television roles include our favorite, Frank, in Smash, Andrew Baker in 13 Reasons Why, as well as Evil, Mozart in the Jungle, Hawkeye, The Big C, and more. Our guest is a world-renowned concert and cabaret artist and has appeared on stages including Carnegie Hall, the White House, Madison Square Garden, and the Kennedy Center. He even has his own holiday album entitled From Christmas Eve to Christmas Morn and has appeared on countless cast albums and recordings. He is a husband, a father, and a personal hero of ours. please welcome to drama,
Ryan Darcy James.
I think I can go now, right? I mean, after that, that's it.
Were you like yawning and falling asleep?
No, I was just kind of going down memory lane there. It's kind of wild to hear all that spelled out. Were you contractually obligated to do that by my publicist?
Yes, yes. You have a great publicist. I'll just leave that
there. Oh, that's very nice. I'll tell Amy that you said that. She can hear it. She can hear it for herself.
Yes, you're right. Absolutely. Brian, I can't believe you're here.
I'm delighted to be here. Nice to meet both of you.
So nice to meet you. You know, we like to check in with our guests when they join the drama family. We're wondering, are you well?
Wow. So right out of the gate, just right going right into it. Yeah, I am well. It's April, you know, the sun is shining. I think we turned the corner. Spring is, I think, here. So that helps a lot, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I brought it with me in my suitcase.
Oh, good for you. Yeah. A little Ohio springtime is always nice.
Exactly.
I'm from Michigan, so I understand what that means, and it's important to me. But generally speaking, yeah, I guess the one thing that would maybe not cloud it, but since we're talking about drama and we're talking about this profession that I'm in and theater, you know, we closed a show, we closed Days of Wine and Roses a couple of weeks ago now. So I'm in that phase of having to readjust to quote unquote normal life after, you know, 8 shows a week. With any show is really hard. But with this particular show, it was so demanding and so equally rewarding that, you know, not doing it takes some time to get used to, not seeing everybody that you're working with so closely with and just the family that you kind of gather along the way. And then all of a sudden you're having to say goodbye to that. So that's hard. I mean, that's the one thing that I'm negotiating right now in my life. But all in all, I am well.
I'm glad to hear it.
I totally understand. I mean, this time is crazy to begin with. And it was a limited run. So it was going to go to the end of April anyway. So you would still have been in that vibe
correct,
right now.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, congratulations on that performance. I know I'm devastated that Dylan missed it because it's one that has sat with me. And like I said, there is more product on the grocery store shelf this year than I think ever.
Yeah.
And it is one that I saw, and it, as the weeks have gone by, I mean, it blew me away. It blew me away. It touched me. The music was stunning. You and Kelly, I mean, the best I've ever seen you both.
Thank you very much.
Truly, congrats.
Thank you. Yeah. The show itself, I think, has that effect because it is unique and it comes at you in a very different way, I think. And so if you go along for the ride, it can have a seismic impact on you based on the nature of the struggles that these characters deal with, but also just the way that the music, I just think Adam Gettle's music is extraordinary and beautiful and soulful and, you know, every other, you know, adjective that kind of connotes beauty and awe. But he kind of manages a way to tell this story through the music that is very surprising, unexpected, and, you know, moving. It really gets inside of, it certainly did for me. And I'm hopefully from what you're saying, Connor, that you know, it can have that effect on people that see it as well.
100%. And it was surprising. I mean, you hear the plot and you think it's going to be one thing and it's so much more. So I really think I wish more people could have seen it.
I know.
But
I know it's that age old thing. Is it better to have loved and lost, but to have never loved at all? I mean, we got to do this thing at the Atlantic first, and which is an extraordinary run, thanks to Neil Pepe and the Atlantic. And then we moved it miraculously to Broadway, which is never a guarantee when you're doing something, you know, off Broadway. Sometimes you think like, oh, okay, this has the possibility, and you just never know. And so credit to our producers who wanted to take that chance and give it a life in a commercial venue in the beautiful space of Studio 54, which is a great fit for us, I think. So yeah, I mean, the fact that we got to do it at all is such a huge hurdle to jump over. I'm so grateful for it.
Yeah. You're so close to it having just finished. So maybe this is hard for you to look back so soon, but what was the moment every night that meant so much to you?
Well, boy, I mean, there's so many really, but the first thing that popped into my head was near the end of the play where Joe, my character, is coming to try and to retrieve his wife, Kirsten, played by Kelly O'Hara. She's in a motel and she's lost herself completely in the throes of alcohol and has kind of just walked away from her life and has, for the worse, just decided that motel is where she wants to be. And it's very sad and it's very harrowing. And there's a scene between Joe and Kirsten where he's trying to basically extricate her from that awful situation, and she doesn't want to go. And it's a scene that is a great drama scene. And Kelly's work in it was just always so extraordinary. And one of the great things that Michael Greif, our director, was allowed us to do was to, you know, to understand the parameters of the whole show and in each scene, but, you know, never be beholden to having to honor particular things in terms of emotional beats. So it was surprising every single night, you know, all within the parameters of what we had built structurally. But in terms of the emotional life, you just never knew it was going to happen. A lot of that had to do is defined by the fact that these characters oftentimes are inebriated. So that is unpredictable behavior, to say the least. So that kind of element within the technique of delivering that scene was just a stunning thing to behold and a stunning thing to participate in.
Yeah. Well, that scene is definitely one that I'll look back on, both of you. What an emotional roller coaster. Yeah. That's like definitely the, you know, if they were showing like a reel for your consideration for awards, that's the one I'd show. I mean, definitely for Kelly.
For
and
sure.
You have other great moments too. What's the song called that you sing towards the end of the show with your sponsor?
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Ryan, and your voice went, it soared so high. I've never heard you sound better.
Oh, that's so nice. That was a really a beautiful song, an incredible song, and a really difficult song for me. It was a kind of a bête noire for me for a while in terms of my own demons trying to, you know, kind of tap me on the shoulder and say, "You can't do this. You can't sing this song. Who do you think you are?" And, you know, I had some difficulties with it, but, you know, just to be totally honest, but we found a way to kind of figure it out. Kim Grigsby, our music director, was incredibly supportive and helpful in trying to find ways to, you know, because when you're working on something, whether it's a song or a scene or the whole trajectory of a character, there are often times when you feel like, I don't know how to do this. I really don't know. Or I'm having real problems with connecting this to this. And that was a song that had those elements for me. But ultimately, you know, I felt like I was able to find it for sure and feel really comfortable. And yeah, it is it's a defining moment for the character for sure. And it's a song that I remember hearing it the first time when Adam sent me the demo of him singing. By the way, Adam Gettle has an incredible singing voice.
Oh, I don't know if I knew that.
Oh, yeah. You should go to his website and listen to the demos of a lot of the songs he has. This is a tangent, but I did Floyd Collins for him. And I was in the workshop of it way before it became the Playwrights Horizons version. And I got a cassette tape of a demo of him singing The Ballad of Floyd Collins and Daybreak, two songs from the show. Anyway, this is a tangent, but the point is that his voice was extraordinary. I couldn't believe it was the composer, a guy at that point who I'd never met. But anyway, I remember hearing Forgiveness, and that came somewhat into the process of developing the show. So it wasn't always there. And I remember when I heard it, I thought, oh, this is so great as a musical moment to define Joe Clay in the context of his story. So story-wise, it was great, but also musically, it was just, I was crying at the end of listening to it. It's just an extraordinary song.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
how much do you know about like the origins of this musical? I know that when we spoke with Kelly, she said that it was an idea that she sort of had with Adam and they talked about it. When did you come into the picture and did Adam sort of write for your voice?
Yes. I was there from the beginning in the sense that Kelly and I, I'm sure you guys covered this ground, but Kelly and I had just finished Sweet Smell of Success, and there is no "the" at the beginning. But just to answer that question.
Thank you so much. I don't know why I imagined that there was.
It's okay. It's okay.
A lot of people do.
It is okay.
It's just sweet.
This is the one thing I'm going to talk about later is something that's really bothering me. When people say "the Sweet Smell of Success," I'm joking. I'm joking. So we had just finished that musical, and she had gone to the Sundance Theater Lab working on another project altogether I love this story, where Adam was working on a new show called, at that point, The Light in the Piazza, and they needed someone to sing some of the material. They needed a young female to sing it. And someone said, well, that girl Kelly over there sings. And she had no overlap with them at all. So she just walked in and started singing stuff with Adam. And he was like, oh my God, I mean, this is what I'm imagining. And they forged a fast working relationship and friendship. And it was in that time when she said to Adam, and this has been on her mind coming out of Sweet Smell of Success, which was kind of the Cafe Society late 50s world of New York City. It reminded her of Days of Wine and Roses, a movie that she loved. And she said to Adam, you should write a musical version of Days of Wine and Roses for myself and this guy that I just worked with, Brian D'Arcy James. And they started talking about it, and Adam thought it was a good idea. And so 21 years ago, something like that, that's how the evolution began. And when did I get involved, like physically, like actually being there? I remember there was another writer that was attached to it before that. And we had a guy named John Logan, and we did a workshop of, I think maybe the first act at his apartment, I think. Maybe it was Adam's apartment. And so it was just Adam's way of saying, this is what I have now, and this is what I see it as being. So it was constantly morphing, constantly changing, constantly being readdressed. But the long story short is that Kelly and I were always there in his mind, which is, I've never had that happen for me. And to have that happen with someone like Adam Gettle is something that I think is one of the, just the treasures of my lifetime and my career.
What a miracle that it then made it to Broadway in this time.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really special.
It is miraculous. It is.
Congrats to you. I know I'm sad that I didn't get to see it, but I'm glad there's an album. I would like to kind of switch gears just a little bit. I go back to maybe the beginning of this, you know, this is the most recent. Go back to something in the beginning. I know you grew up in Michigan, but we do like to talk to all of our guests about the Ring of Keys moment. You've done some Janine Tesori work in your career.
That's right.
Borrow this from Fun Home. It's like that aha moment when you saw something or someone and you thought, oh, I want to do that. I want to be like them. Do you feel like you had a Ring of Keys moment?
Well, I knew that you both wanted to kind of address this idea, which I love this. I love this idea. So I really thought about it, and I was thinking, okay, what actually is it? Because there are a lot of stock answers that I've said along the way, and all of them true to you know a certain point. But I really wanted to think about it and just say, what is the one little crystallized thing? And I don't know if this is the definitive moment, but it certainly is something that stands out in my head. And it's kind of obscure in a way. It was when I was just starting to learn how to act in college. And so I was just, you know, fired up with the zeal of a new recruit who was just all in on acting and drama and film and just everything about it. I was just, you know, passionately in love with what I was doing. And I remember coming home on a spring break that my sophomore year of college, and, you know, on a list of movies that someone said, you got to watch these movies, I watched Rebel Without a Cause, starring James Dean, who, of course, I'd heard of James Dean before, but I didn't know him as an actor. I didn't know his work per se. I knew the imagery. I knew the iconography of who he was. So the moment that I remember being kind of struck and kind of, I just took my breath away for reasons I can't understand, which was the very beginning of the movie. I don't know if you know this film, but so James Dean is basically, if I'm not mistaken, he's a little drunk and he's on the street where he lives, and he kind of collapses onto the ground and has this little moment with a toy monkey.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of looking at it longingly, and it's very poignant and it's very weird. And it's just something about that moment for me was so mysterious and so powerful, and just the performance. It was just like the beginning of that performance in that film, which I thought was like, it just felt like something watching something else, you know, something that I didn't really understand in terms of what you can do as an actor. But that moment had a really, really big, big impact on me. It just kind of, I remember it kind of like, you know, sending up a flare in my head saying, oh, that's something to note, you know, that is something that to aspire to. And interestingly, I was looking up that moment because I thought, oh, I want to learn more about it. And I learned that he totally improvised that. They were at the end of a long, long day, and it was the last part of the day, well into the morning. And he said to the director, he said, I have an idea. I want to do something. And I was like, okay, what do you want to do? And so he got this little monkey and he put it on the ground. He collapsed down and started talking to it, looking at it and playing with it. It was totally unscripted. Nothing to do with the story and the original telling of it. And it became this kind of classic beginning of a classic seminal film. So,
oh, I love that story.
That's an interesting aspect to it, because I think there's probably something in that, in the performance of just something that is pure, instinctive, instinctual, outside of the bounds of the kind of quote unquote norm. All of those things were actually literally happening in the construction of it. And I think translated in the actual telling of it, which may have had, you know, other than the fact that James Dean was just so captivating to watch, but that might have something to do with why it was kind of ringing in a different way.
Oof. I love that you did your research on it, Brian.
Well, I really thought about it because I thought, you know, what are the things? Because there's a lot of them, of course. You both know there are in any life, there are lots of moments where you could say, well, that was huge. That was a pivotal moment. Mm-hmm. And like I said, that is one of them. I don't know if it was the one where I was like, I am forever going to be an actor. but it did resonate with me in a way that made me kind of, yeah, maybe feel just that way.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Oh, I love that. Did you become like a longtime fan then of James Dean? And
yeah, of course. Yeah, I started like, what else? What else? What else has he done?
Was the Giant musical that's based on the movie that James Dean was in?
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. Yeah. So but I didn't play that part though in the musical, but James Dean was definitely in that movie for sure.
Were you Rock Hudson?
I was, yeah.
What a great, yeah. What's his name in that again? I forget.
Bick Benedict.
How could I forget? How could yeah. I forget? Oh, that's so fun. How was that musical?
Oh, it was glorious. Another Michael Greif directed production by Michael John Lacusif. And it was just an incredible, incredible production. The expanse of that story, I thought, was represented beautifully by the music. And his music was able to kind of, you know, go from one thing to the other in such a huge sweeping gesture. You know, I always thought it was kind of an opera in a way. Jennifer, my wife, always said this as well. Probably would have a great life in light operas because you could have more space with it in a bigger stage. Because we did it down at the Public and we're limited with the space we had. But I think space probably helps that production because it is about, you know, a vast, vast land. That's a huge part of the story. Anyway, it was great. It was a great
that's
great production.
It's also such a sweeping story that takes place over so many years too. And yeah, I could totally see that as an opera. So, okay. So you're talking about James Dean. He's able to lean into his weirdness in Rebel Without a Cause and lean into his instincts and really play. Is that the kind of actor you are? Do you like to follow your instincts or are you more of like a prepared by the script, et cetera, kind of performer?
That's a really good question. I think it's a combination of both. I think at that time, I'll never forget something that my acting teacher was telling me, you know, I was 19, right out of high school. And a good teacher's job is to kind of strip away the things that are successful, but not necessarily thought out. And he would call it my bag of tricks. And I was able to kind of succeed by virtue of some of the things that I was able to do in High School Musicals or whatever. Just, you don't know anything. You're just kind of doing naturally what you can do. And I think at that point in my life, I was very concerned about wanting to do just that, to kind of knock away the things that didn't really rely on thought and get to a place where I was learning actual technique and really having an idea as to why I was doing something as opposed to just doing it. Mm-hmm. But now, actually, you know, these many, many years later, ironically, I want to get to a place where I can do all that. This is nothing new. This is such an actor thing to say, but you do all that work to understand all of the technical cogs of the machine and how they turn, only to say, okay, I know that, so let's just forget it all and just let all of the things that I've thought about and learned just, you know, steep in that and then have that be the guide for which, you know, my instincts can, you know, take hold.
Yeah. That's really cool.
That's the goal.
Do you like when you're kind of just in the work or do you prefer once you get to that place where you can kind of just not let loose per se, but ease into something in a different way?
Yeah, I think I like it best when all of the elements are in place and you can start to kind of let go a little bit and let the kind of inner voice take over. For me, that's really fun and exciting. And if you're working with people that are like-minded in that pursuit, it's the best because especially with a director who says, okay, let's see where this can go and not have a preconceived notion of it. That to me, I think is where I get super excited about the process of rehearsing a show because it does lead to really incredible discovery.
Yeah, for sure. Oh my God, you've done so many. I mean, we listed everything. I mean, I don't even know like where to go into here, but we talked about Shrek before you joined the convo. Again, huge for me while learning how to drive. So I'll always associate that. And also randomly, the Catherine Zeta-Jones A Little Night Music album was big for me that summer. I got it from the local library on CD and burnt it to my MP3 player. So that's how I heard it. But
amazing. Wow.
But anyway, Shrek. Okay. So they're still working on Shrek. Like they went back and they're retooling it now again. But
yeah,
the version of Shrek that you were in, was that 2008, 2009?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
When you look back on Shrek, What do you think about?
Oh, well, I think of two things. I mean, the fact that it is still so alive says something about the show. It is an extraordinary show, I believe. And one that has really had a huge impact. I can't tell you the number of times people will come out and tell me that that was a seminal experience for them and introduced theater to a lot of young people, many of whom are, you know, your age now, I imagine, and are very aware of theater, really love theater. So, and of course, the Netflix live capture of it was instrumental in that as well. It is a show that has long life for good reason. And that is because of David Lindsay-Abaire and Jeanine Tesori. So what do I think of? I think of two things. I think of the joy of being that character and how funny and fun and freeing it was to sing a song where you're literally farting on stage with Sutton Foster.
Yes.
Or just like looking into Daniel Breaker's eyes, trying not to laugh because he's so incredibly funny. Or Chris, you know, Siever as Farquaad and just thinking, I don't think you could get funnier than this. You know, all these comic geniuses in this show. It was a joyful, joyous thing. And then, of course, singing that music is just incredible.
Oh, my God.
So that's the first thing. And then followed very closely by get me out of this big fat head. Because it was really, really, really difficult. It was a very big challenge to get in that makeup every night. It took an hour and a half to get in, took about an hour to get out. So I couldn't get out in between shows because I would just literally be in the makeup chair from beginning to end. It just wouldn't be fair to the makeup artist or me. It was a really tough work experience in that regard. And so, you know, thank God I had an extraordinary group of people that were, you know, literally in my face, you know, a good portion of the day. And just, I love them so much. They had the great attitude. That is a particular skill, I think, when you're working like that. And thankfully, it was a really great kind of a chemistry of people there that were really doing incredible work. So those two things are the things that I think about. It was probably the most challenging thing I've ever had to do because of that. But the rewards of it were so bountiful, you know, with just getting to be that character and just, you know, just living that in that world was super fun.
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine it was probably an interesting feeling to step out on stage looking like that, so different from yourself.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That voice and, you know, every the accent.
I think I thought you were Scottish.
Well, I think maybe you were the only one.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
No, yeah, that's true. That's true, Dylan. I did feel like I, you know, mask work is something I did a little bit in college with, and this is obviously, you know, that kind of thing. And so to lose yourself in that way, not only with the facial makeup, but the costume of it. It was an extraordinary exploration of character, you know, and seeing how the external would inform the internal as much as the opposite way around as well. This is something I haven't ever really talked about, but it's coming to my mind, and it didn't necessarily have any effect on the character per se, but I wanted to model Shrek's movement on Joe Cocker. I don't know if you know that singer. He had a really interesting way of contorting his body. Yeah. And again, it didn't really actually make it into the actual characterization, but there's just so your listeners know, there's a Joe Cocker DNA in my version of Shrek for better or for worse.
I love it. We got the exclusive on that one. And then that same Broadway season, Next to Normal is happening, you know, a couple blocks away, a show that you were attached to at various points in its creative process and then eventually joined. I know you've spoken a lot about, you know, choosing to not continue with it and to do Shrek.
I haven't spoken a lot about it.
Not too much, no? Yeah, what was that decision process like?
Well, it was a tough decision, but the long story short was when Next to Normal opened at Second Stage, the producers decided that they wanted to continue to work on it in a regional aspect. And at that time, I started auditioning for Shrek. And as I was auditioning and getting closer to getting that part, there were two options for Next to Normal. One was to go to, La Jolla, I think La Jolla. And then the other one was to go to DC, which is where it ultimately went for its arena stage for its next iteration. And it was still up in the air. They didn't know if it was going to happen. I think everyone felt it was probably going to happen. They didn't know where it was going to be. And then in the midst of that, I get this role. And so I had to decide whether or not I should take this role for a Broadway show that was definitely going to happen or wait and see what was going to happen with this production of Next to Normal. Yeah, so it was definitely a Sophie's choice because Next to Normal what an extraordinary show that was. You know, I love that show. I'm so grateful that I had a small part in playing that part in that part of the evolution of that show. But I just basically, you know, I was maybe thinking ahead of wanting to kind of like, you know, have some money in the bank, you know, for future college for my daughter, you know, just, you know, all those kinds of practical things that go into your head thinking like, well, do I take the bird in the hand now? I mean, this is oftentimes the decision-making process of an actor. You know, yeah. You have to kind of assess, you know, sometimes literal things with not imaginary things, but things that aren't necessarily cemented yet. And there's a lot of times you make those decisions in a leap of faith way.
Mm-hmm. Now, the theater fanatics out there are going to be like, Connor, how could you be so stupid? But is there any version of you singing I've Been from Next to Normal out there in the world? You know, the song what's his name?
Dan
gets to sing at the end of Act One.
Not that I know of. I'm sure, you know, these days you can probably find anything online. I've never seen it.
Oh my God.
I've never seen it.
I feel like you would demolish that number. That's honestly one of my favorite songs in a show full of bop after bop. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that score is incredible. Yeah. Is it not? I mean, my God. That show was so striking. I mean, obviously playing opposite Alice and what she was doing, which was otherworldly and so great and recognized as such.
Right.
But, you know, Jen Damiano playing my daughter, I think about that moment at the end. At that point, Grace, my daughter, was probably 6 or 5. And so to have a moment where I was, you know, kind of looking forward and understanding the dynamic of a young woman who is on the verge of, you know, becoming a young adult and just having to go through all this drama and trauma. That was such an incredible moment that I'll never, ever forget, that moment in the show when she comes and basically tells her dad that, you know, that they can move forward. They can try to move forward, which strangely, there's a very similar replication of that moment in Days of Wine and Roses with a younger girl. Those two shows share a lot of the same DNA in a way.
I have goosebumps, Brian. You're so right. That is a very profound moment.
It's tricky topics too that I think, you know, affect, you know, almost virtually everyone, you know, in different ways.
Absolutely.
But maybe are captured in musical ways normally.
Well, yeah, I think that's what makes it so powerful, because that's the last way you'd expect to have a story like that be delivered. And so, you know, it takes imagination and skill, you know, by the likes of Craig Lucas and Brian Yorkie and Tom Kitt and Adam Gettle to say, how do we do this? Like, how do we literally do this? And that is a talent that is, you know, baffles me. You know, in my regard.
I have to say, you were talking about how funny all of your Shrek co-stars were, and you were so funny in that too. But I mean, one of my favorite surprising musical experiences ever was watching Something Rotten.
Funniest thing.
Oh my God. I laughed my little bottom off.
Yeah, that was a funny show, and you know, I was the straight man in that for sure.
Yeah,
and talk about, you know, a murderer's row of, you know, Brad Oscar, Brooks Eschmanskas, Kate Reinders. I mean, you know, Heidi and Christian Borle, John Cariani.
Yes,
everybody who had 1 ounce of business to do made it a ton. You know, that was. I'll never forget hearing the pitch about that show, you know, just the kind of, this is what it is, you know, these writers, and he's one step behind Shakespeare. So he goes to a soothsayer who's, you know, not necessarily Nostradamus. I mean, the whole thing was so like dad joke city, you know, that sounds like a pejorative, but it was actually like, this is what I must do.
Yeah.
it was so incredibly funny to me. And, you know, the fact that Omelette was, you know, the thing that they made, it was just so stupid and hilarious. And this is an interesting story. I remember I was a bit of a name drop in a way, but it's true. We were doing the workshop of Something Rotten, and I had to leave a little bit early for an unexpected reshoot for Spotlight. They added a scene that wasn't on the docket, and they needed it after we had finished shooting.
Now, can you say what the scene was?
The scene was when Matt Carroll goes to the doorstep of the priest that literally lives around the corner from him. And after the article has been written, he takes a bundle of Boston Globe papers with the headline at the top, you know, just boldly and glaringly stating these horrors. And he drops it on the front step of this household where this priest that's in remission, you know,
right.
Quote unquote.
That scene.
And so that was the scene. They didn't have that moment, that kind of that little punctuation of a storyline, particularly for that, for Matt Carroll, which is true, by the way, that actually literally happened. He lived right around the corner from this when he was kind of discovering, you know, what was going on with the cover up in the Catholic Church. So anyway, that was the one scene that we had to get. And there was another scene too, that we had to do with Michael Keaton and Matt Carroll talking about placing a bet, you know, a friendly bet on whether or not the judge was going to rule in their favor about a particular release of names. So they just needed, you know, just wonky stuff. Yeah. That made that movie so incredibly powerful because it was all based in such reality, and every moment was so meticulously researched and brought to life by Tom McCarthy and Josh Singer. Incredible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I'm there doing that, and I come back, and I've missed a couple of days. And by the time I get back, Casey Nicholas says, "Hey, let me show you what we worked on. We basically put together the finale." And I sat down and I watched. I watched Omelette in front of my eyes for the first time, you know, with literally dancing eggs and people with frying pans. And I could not believe what I was seeing. It was the most blissful moment of my life. You know, it was just like, this is so funny to me. So yeah, that is a great show.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely loved it. You were fantastic. And of course, that was one of your many Tony nominations that you've had over the years. Very well deserved. I remember we did like the rush and got to be in the front row, and just seeing all of that explode before our very eyes was thrilling.
Oh, that's fun.
And then you returned to the St. James, you know, in the last year, another Tony.
Was it 2 years? Wait,
was it 2 years ago now?
Yes. I think it was 2 years ago now.
Yeah. How is that possible? Last year, cause like last year's award season.
That's right.
And Into the Woods. What was it like doing Sondheim on that scale back at the St. James?
That whole production was like the biggest gift that I could never have imagined, you know, what it would bring in terms of the feeling of having been in such a, in a show that had such a, just people were so happy that it was there and it was so well done, and everything about it was just, it was such a gift because I wasn't there at the very beginning. And I remember when Lear Debesnay, the director, called me and said, "Hey, do you want to play the baker in this production that's moving to Broadway?" And I thought, because I knew that they had done it. And I was like, well, sure, of course. Yeah, that sounds incredible. And I had no idea kind of how it started at City Center and how it was being so, you know, raucously received, and everyone was hoping that would continue, and it did. That in and of itself was, I mean, there's three things. There's doing Sondheim and finding a full appreciation for his genius, and, you know, really kind of truly kind of my own limited understanding of you know, his genius, and just fully appreciating that in a new way. Getting to be in this show that had all of this love and support and movement of success behind it, that was thrilling, you know, because that doesn't always happen. It's you never know kind of what's going to happen when you start a show that seemed to be kind of baked in from the beginning, no pun intended. Just kind of was there, you know, and which was ecstatic. It was just a beautiful feeling. And then, you know, getting to be opposite Sarah Bareilles, who I'm such a fan of, and now really kind of boggles my mind that I can call her a friend. And she's just an extraordinary person. But to do that with her, and to share that with, you know, Gavin Creel and you know, everybody there was top notch.
Yeah. Top-notch. It was like the Avengers of Broadway.
Kind of was. Yeah. And then, you know, a year later, a Tony nomination for it, and then a Grammy Award.
Yes.
It's such a testament to, sometimes you work really, really hard to make something happen. I want this to happen. I'm going to do everything I can. And all of that effort is definitely noble and worthwhile. And can sometimes pay off. And sometimes it can be like a tree in the forest that falls. Nobody sees it or hears it.
Yeah.
And then there are things that just fall into your lap and are like this gold bullion that falls from the sky. And you just like, how did I get so lucky to be a part of this? Yeah. That's what that experience was for me.
That's really special. Yeah, I'm curious, just what is your relationship to awards and all of that stuff? I mean, it's so complicated. It's such a small community. And, you know, you've been nominated for many Tonys and you've won a bunch of Drama Desks and OBs, you know, things like that.
I won one Drama Desk.
What was the Drama Desk for?
It was Shrek.
Our critics for Shrek as
well. They loved the Scottish accent as well.
They did. And the fat suit.
Yes, of course.
They
of course.
Love a transformation.
What is my relationship to it? Well, look, it is the longer you go on through this process, and you know, you realize, not to be too cynical about it, but you know, there is a self-sustaining necessity of having to kind of, you know, send flares up and say this is what's happening, so the industry people can see it from a different perspective, and a greater number of people can understand what's happening. And hey, look, they're celebrating it, so we should celebrate it too, and we should make money doing that, et cetera, et cetera. So that's all part of the ad campaign of it, which is necessary, and I get it. You know, and it is easy to fall into the trap of feeling like, you know, oh boy, I want this, you know, but if you take a step back and think about it, really, it's like, what, at the expense of what? I mean, why shouldn't that person get it as well? Why shouldn't everybody who's nomination or not? Why shouldn't we all have a Tony? It is such incredibly hard work. And, you know, 8 shows a week is no joke. So from a kind of a worker bee mentality, everyone deserves that. So it's a weird thing to kind of, it's weird and wonderful. I mean, don't get me wrong. When the nominations that I've been able to get, it is always a very special feeling of having recognition for the things that you're doing. And ultimately that's a good thing. And that feels good. But you know, it can be a weird thing to try to reconcile that with the idea that some people don't, and that doesn't seem right either, you know? Yeah. And then you start kind of trying to understand, well, how could you possibly grade something, you know, for its value based on an objective or subjective point of view on quality, you know? So that's a very kind of, you know, complicated and boring answer to your question.
No, it was interesting.
But yeah, it is fun. That's for sure. You know, cause you're there with all of your heroes and all of the people that, you know, really well, and then some people that you've never met who you've adored from afar for a long time, and all of a sudden you're having salmon with them, you know, and talking about, you know, what it was like to do this or that. That to me is always the most exciting and rewarding part, is to kind of be amongst your colleagues and have that moment of communion in a way, and to say, like, you know, this is we're all doing this together. We all understand what this is.
That would be so fun. Do you like ever think about what you'd say if they call your name, like for the Tony? Do you have your little dream speech in your head?
All right, I'll be totally honest with you. I've done that, and I've started like in my head. I'll start like, okay, what happens now? Okay, get up there and say, I'd like to thank the, and I get to the, I'd like to thank the, and I say, this is absolute horseshit. Why am I doing this? So I just abandon it and just go, you know, do something. I watch, you know, watch television or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking to you about so many different things. We were mostly on the stage here, a little spotlight action in there.
Yes. Which we loved, by the way.
Yeah. Oh my God. Congrats on that.
Thank
Absolutely
you.
Iconic. I was also thinking you've been on Broadway this season. Rachel's been on Broadway this season. Liev's been on Broadway this season.
Yeah.
You're all,
I know. I'm going to see Rachel's play on Sunday night. I'm going to go to the opening of that play.
Oh, fun. I love her. I've got to talk about Smash. Now, do people always want to talk about Smash with you?
Not always, but a good amount. Definitely. That has a huge fan base. And when you think of Smash, I think you automatically think of Frank Houston. Will he or will he not play Marilyn? I mean, that really, so I understand the passion behind the interest, but that was a great experience too.
Yeah. Oh my God. Was that your first big TV gig?
Yeah, totally. It was my first time doing a recurring spot on a primetime television show, which was so great. And the fact that it was in my bailiwick, the story was something I understood. It was literally, you know, in New York, so I didn't have to go far to do it. I didn't have to leave my family. I mean, all these things were just kind of like, it was a godsend.
Yeah.
And, you know, and a lot of friends were working on it as well, and made a lot of new friends on it as well. So, yeah, I mean, I will say that I think, you know, the one thing that has that cracks me up about my time being in that show is that after a while, there was a group of super fans that I'm totally indebted to for having any kind of interest in what I was doing on it. But I think they spearheaded this drinking game when you watch Smash, that every time Frank Houston makes a salad for his wife, Deborah Messing, you'd have to drink a beer. You know, so Smash fans would be drunk by, you know, like the fourth page of the episode. Like, hey, honey, chopping carrots, you know, chopping celery.
I do picture him at that counter. It wasn't he always there? Yeah.
Yeah. He was always in the kitchen. And all joking aside, that's because Teresa Rebeck, she told me Teresa's husband is a great cook.
Oh.
I think she modeled a bit of that aspect on his acumen in the kitchen. So yeah. And you know, it was also a way of telling the story, like who was at home and who was not at home, right. Which was not, you know, not the usual thing, or at least, you know, it was a nice version of our story was that, you know, she was off kind of doing her show thing and he was at home, you know, taking care of their son.
Yeah.
But yeah, I also remember that when we shot the pilot of it, just talk about convenience. In the pilot episode, the Houston household was literally, I'm looking out my window, and if the building that I'm looking at wasn't there, I'd be looking at the apartment where we shot that.
Oh my God.
I had to walk around the corner. It was incredibly bizarre.
Oh, wow.
It's wild how it's really lived on. And I know the fan response has changed significantly since it first aired. I mean, we always loved it.
We always did.
Unironically. Yeah. But, you know, there was the hate watching trend. There was the people who loved it. There was people who didn't love it, but kept going. There was its resurgence as it wasn't even on streaming. But then right around COVID, people were all like, oh, my God, we're obsessed with Smash. Bring back Smash. And now there's Bombshell coming to Broadway. It's
wild. It is wild. Undeniable. I mean, it doesn't surprise me in that sense, in that there's definitely something there for sure. Yeah. Obviously, there's something there. But, you know, Mark Shaiman, Scott Whitman, I mean, come on. It, you know, the score of that Broadway musical is going to be incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible. I don't see any future for Frank Houston in the show.
Justice for Frank, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, we have had such a great time chatting with you. We do need to wrap up.
Oh, no, it can't be over.
And we do like to end on a dose of drama, which I know you hinted a little bit earlier about the sweet smell of success, but it's where you can kind of like, you know, promote something, talk about, you know, whatever's been on your mind and whatnot. I will kick it off if you don't mind, because
please.
I don't have to talk about the Wild Party yet, but it's kind of interesting. We're having a Wild Party sort of redux happening with these Gatsby musicals that are both happening at the same time. One is on Broadway, right. One's going to be going to Cambridge. And I just think it's so ironic. I'm actually going to turn this into a question for you, Brian. When Wild Party was happening, were both of them on stage at the same time, or was
yeah.
it? Okay, they were literally at the same time.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to see the other one?
I never did. I never had the chance. I remember hearing a woman during our show at intermission was over her saying, Eartha Kitt's not in this. She was very, very disappointed.
But you had Julia Murray. I mean, the cast was just, and Adina, like that was just Tay. It was just such a great, great group.
Yes, it was.
And I'd be curious to see what the legacies are of these two Gatsbys now, you know, because both Wild Parties are still performed, you know.
I know it. Isn't that interesting how something gets into the ether and you know, someone grabs it and someone else grabs it. And it's just kind of like, well, whoever blinks first, I guess.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Actually, Wild Party is one of my blinds. Both Wild Parties are a little bit of a blind spot for me.
Got it.
I have to dive in, I think.
Oh, well, look, that Andrew Lippa's work on that is just great. I mean, that album is great. Yeah. It's a great album. Yeah. So yeah, start there for sure.
I'm going to do it.
What is it about? I mean, oh my God. How were you not just so vocally exhausted after that? I mean, every single performance.
Yeah, that was a great song. I really, really enjoyed that song. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dose of drama for me. Okay. This happened a few weeks ago, but we haven't recorded. I got to see Patti LuPone at Carnegie Hall, and it was a sensational night. A surprising night. The whole first half, she really didn't do any, I think she did one song from Gypsy, but it was just songs from her life that have meant a lot to her as she talked through her experiences. But then in the second half, she did do a medley of like, I Dreamed a Dream, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina.
The hits,
the ones that she knew we wanted to hear. And it was such a well put together concert of doing what she wanted to do, doing what she knew the fans wanted to hear, being funny, well scripted. I mean, it was just phenomenal. I absolutely loved it. And she's great.
That was at Carnegie Hall?
At Carnegie Hall.
Oh,
yeah,
fantastic.
It's a show she's taken around the country, believe it or not. My friend saw it in California. But
oh, cool.
Anyway, have you ever worked with her, Brian? Or
no, I never have. I've never worked with her.
Interesting. You've worked with everyone. I mean, all the greats over the years. Yeah, I meant to ask you earlier, like you worked with John Lithgow, like so many incredible people. Was there anyone that like passed on phenomenal advice? You don't have to say what the advice was, but someone that you just learned a lot from?
Yes and no. I mean, one thing that popped into my head when you're saying that was Michael Keaton. When I was my first scene with him in the movie Spotlight, where My character has to go in, and like it's just the two of us. And I'd met him because we had rehearsed a bit, and so it wasn't a complete, you know, I wasn't completely knees knocking moment because you know it was just a semi knees knocking moment.
It's because Batman.
I love that guy exactly. I mean, this was something I'll never forget. That was really, really helpful and to me. And we did our first take of the scene, and he was across the desk, and I was doing my thing, and you know. I don't know if he sensed that I was nervous or he just wanted to be a team player or any, cause I know he meant it, but he just gave me a thumbs up. Like, nice job. Keep, you know, just, you know, good job. That was a good job in that scene. And you know, it meant the world to me because, you know, I was always kind of like waiting for the other shoe to drop, you know, thinking like, oh, we meant the other Brian guy, who's a movie star. That's who we thought should be in this movie. So I was always waiting for that conversation to someone to tap me on the shoulder and say, oh, not you. So, you know, just getting those kinds of little nods of assent were really, really helpful. Really. And, wow. you know, a little thing can go a long way.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. That's beautiful. Do you have a dose of drama for us to take us home?
Well, I was thinking about this too, and so it's more of a pop culture thing. It's kind of what has captivated me, and I'm so sad that it's over, but I just binged Ripley on Netflix.
Me too.
I can't say enough about that show. Just the way that it's shot, it's black and white, but it's so exquisitely shot, and it's Andrew Scott plays the title role, and it really kind of takes its time getting into the psychology and the step-by-step process of a con man trying to figure out how he's going to take care of grisly things, mundane things. It is one of the best things I think I've ever seen on television. So yeah, that's what popped up into my head.
Yeah. Oh God, it was so good. How satisfying was it to watch him cover up those murders?
Like, oh, stop. You've spoiled it.
But right. I mean, something they don't have time for in the Talented Mr. Ripley film, that the hour would fly by of him doing what
just that's what I loved about it is that it really kind of really put you in the place of how grotesque and laborious and the workaday aspect of what's required to do something as grisly as that. You know, it's a bit macabre, but in terms of storytelling, you're right. The series allows for, you know, the time spent with how a million things can go wrong and how you have to spend your time to kind of rectify those things to do something that, you know, is going to serve your own purposes.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It was so good. Oh my God, Brian, this has been a dream.
Yes.
You're
thank you.
The loveliest guy. The rumors are true. Believe it or not. I know you wanted to dispel them, but you are so lovely, so generous with your time and your story. So thank you so much. I do have one final question. I sometimes ask this. It's not a what's next question, but it's a what's your dream? We've talked about so much of your career and we weren't even able to get to lots of it. But what's something that you really would love to do next if you had the choice?
Well, I produced a television show, a sitcom for CBS called How We Roll, starring Pete Holmes. And that was a trial by fire and an incredible experience for me. And I've had my hands on a few things, you know, properties that I wanted to develop that made some progress and then never really came to fruition. But that for me was an experience that was the nuts and bolts, you know, from soup to nuts of having an idea, getting it sold, actually doing it and spending, you know, a good portion of my life producing a television show, which was, I learned so much. That's something I would like to continue to do, find opportunities to use that side of my brain and use that, you know, side of my skill set to kind of bring people in, get people on the same page, accomplish something of telling a great story. I love doing that. And I've spent most of my time, you know, 99% of my time, you know, acting and I love it for sure, but it's nice to be able to kind of use a different muscle and challenge yourself. And that was one of the great things that I loved about doing that show. Kind of walking into something and not necessarily knowing how to do it, but, you know, listening, learning and failing. And then, you know, saying, oh, well, I know how to do that now. And just slowly tick off the list of the things that you've learned so you can apply that the next time. So I'm hoping there's a next time for a producing aspect of my career.
Sure. That's really cool. That made me think, have you ever thought about directing or is that ever?
I have. That's a thought that kind of is coming up more and more for me in terms of conversations and questions that people ask me like that. I've always been skittish about it because I've always marveled at people who have a real clear vision, like a real vision. And that's one thing. But then to be able to somehow magically translate an idea in your head to 100 people to execute that and make it come to life, that is, I mean, it's something I understand because I've seen it happen, but to do it, I guess maybe I'll have to just jump in and try to do that if I want to. But yeah, I think I have to get over my fear of not necessarily understanding that nexus of vision to execution. But you know, maybe one day.
I think you'd be brilliant. Well, thank you for everything, Brian. Thank you for your candor and just all of these great stories and nuggets. It's really been an honor for Connor and I to have you on Drama.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Let's do it again. We'll do part two.
Yeah, we need to get to talk about The Ferryman, which is another one of my.
Oh, God, we could spend an hour on that.
The question will haunt me. Was the Scottish accent and the Irish accent, were they, you know, equally received by audiences?
Well,
alike?
Let's put it this way. I feel a little bit more confident in my Northern Irish accent than I do my Scottish accent. I mean, I'm basically just copying Mike Myers. So that's I'll give him all of the credit if there's any to be had.
In my book, yes.
Absolutely.
And everyone can, of course, follow you on Instagram. You're at Brian Darcy James. And they should follow us. We're at The Drama Podcast. I'm at Dylan McDowell. Connor's at Connor McDowell. Thank you again, Brian. And best wishes with everything that you have coming down the pipe.
Thanks. A real pleasure.
Yeah. And Connor, I will see you next time.
Drama.